This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in their room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I am so delighted to introduce Patricia W. Patricia came all the way from Noonan with a huge posse. Thank you all for coming. Patricia's sobriety date, I'll let her tell you that if she wants to, but she's been sober a long damn time. And thank you so much. Come on up, sweetheart.
My name is Patricia. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is June 18th, 1992. So I wanted to thank everybody for letting me be here, talking me into doing this, 4 or 5 months ago. And I especially want to thank all the women that came here. And thank you for Alcoholics Anonymous for getting me to this point in my life. If you don't mind, I'd like to read this one small little section from the seventh step in the 12 and 12. For just so long, I tend to be a crier from time to time, so just a spoiler alert. I'll try to keep it to a minimum. For just so long as we were convinced that we could live exclusively by our own individual strength and intelligence, for just that long was a working faith and a higher power impossible. This was true even when we believed that God existed. We could actually have earnest religious beliefs which remained barren because we were still trying to play God ourselves. It's just when I cry, it's not because of sad feelings or any kind of bad feelings. It's because oftentimes the words are powerful to me. As long as we placed self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power was out of the question. That basic ingredient of all humility, a desire to seek and do God's will, was missing. And as I was thinking about it and looking, preparing, because I've known about this for 3 or 4 months in fear, right? I was thinking about my life, because it's been a while. I realized that my story is about this revolving door. God and my self-will are in this revolving door. And they're spinning around. And I allow them to take turns running my life. I've always believed that when I first walked into AA that I was ready for the steps. I was looking for the steps. And because I wanted that underlying feeling of grace, that constancy, and that spiritual guidance. And the only way that I could get that before AA was with alcohol. When I talk about the constancy of the principles, of the steps, I'm talking about the principles and the fact, yes, there is consistency, but constancy means it's always there. Once it's a part of you, you can't unknow it. The principles that I'm talking about that underlie the steps are honesty, hope, surrender, courage, integrity, willingness, humility, love, responsibility, discipline, awareness, and service. So unknowingly, I had wanted them since childhood. And the reason I think that is from an experience that I had when I was 6 or 6 and a half years old. My father was in the Navy, and we were stationed at a military air base in Tennessee. God's not a thing in our family. It was more a topic of conversation. We did not have a personal God in our life. But back then, I guess it was around 1953, 54, Billy Graham was a big deal. He was a celebrity. And we didn't have our phones where we could watch a movie on our phone. TVs were still black and white. And the access to entertainment was pretty scarce, especially if you lived out somewhere. So when Billy Graham came to town, you went. I ended up being the oldest of five kids. At this time, there was just me and my two brothers. And so we went to see Billy Graham, and it's in this big sports arena. And in the middle was this, it looked like a giant boxing ring. It was just this big stage with ropes all around it. And we're sitting there in the bleachers, and I'm sitting there with my little brother, and he's like about a year and a half younger than me. I was my charge that day to take care of him. And my mom and my dad were sitting behind us holding my little toddler baby brother. Billy Graham got up to talk. As a child, my father was pretty controlling, but he didn't like us to talk unless we had something important to say, something interesting to him, something profound. So I didn't do a lot of talking. Anyway, so Billy Graham is up there, and he's talking. He's talking about a God where I don't have to be smart. I don't have to be profound. I don't have to be pretty. I don't have to behave. And most importantly, even if I ignored him, he would always be there. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, I want to be up there with Billy Graham. I don't want to be sitting here. I want to be up there with Billy Graham. And then at the end, you know, they ask you to come down if you want a blessing or a prayer. They started playing the music. And there's this man, I can't think of his name, but he's very famous. He was always traveling around with Billy Graham. And he started to sing the song, Just As I Am. And normally you wouldn't do anything unless my dad said it was okay, but I forgot all about that. And I grabbed my little brother's hand, and I said, come on, and we ran down. And because I did it just like that, we were one of the first people, and we were in the line to talk to Billy Graham, not one of his helpers. We're standing there, and it was our turn, and Billy Graham bends down, and he smiles at us, and he says, hello. Just at that moment, my mom had come down after us, and she took us by the hand gently, and she looked up at Billy Graham, and she said, I'm sorry, but she doesn't understand what she's doing. And I remember thinking, but I do understand. I understood everything he said. But, you know, you're 6 and a half, and you're in a grown-up's world. By the time I got home, I just figured, well, maybe I really didn't understand. And so that was the last time that God was in my life until I turned sober 2 months before my 45th birthday. I was born in San Diego, California in 1947, one of the early baby boomers. And my father was an enlisted man in the Navy, and my mom worked in a store. Both of my parents were from Tucumcari, New Mexico, which is this little dusty town on Route 66. My dad was the third youngest of seven boys and two girls. I looked it up about 8 or 10 years ago, and every single one of those boys died by the age of 62, including my father, of either alcohol-related diseases or direct alcohol poisoning. I don't know what happened to my two aunts. I couldn't find them. My mom's family, both families were poor, but my grandmother was a school teacher, and my grandfather worked for the railroad, so they were kind of in a good spot back in those days. I never saw any of them ever drink, but as it turns out, I was named after my mom's brother, my Uncle Patrick. My Uncle Patrick got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and at the time, of course, that they named me after him, they were not aware that my Uncle Patrick and I would follow the same path. My dad was a career person in the Navy. He ended up going to Officers Candidate School. We moved a lot. We all understood that my dad was a man who was not afraid to take out his rage and frustration on his family and all forms of abuse. And so we moved around a lot, and we're dealing with the family situation. And my mom was one of these people that whatever happened, it happened. you went through it and you moved on to the next thing, whether it was an incident or a new place to live or wherever, you just moved on. And I pretty much incorporated that in my life. And it helped because I ended up marrying a man in the military. I've had a very mobile life, I guess. It's that Scarlett O'Hara thing, you know, tomorrow is another day. So I really never drank when I was a kid. I had one drinking episode in high school, and it was just the one time. But it set me up for when I did start drinking at 21, right away. My purpose in drinking was to get drunk. So it's the summer before my senior year. My dad was stationed in D.C., and we lived in Fairfax, Virginia, you know, one of those split-level houses with a den in the bottom and a bar in the den. My parents always had a lot of alcohol in the house. The bar was well stocked. And I was one of these kids where in my house I was quiet. I was social outside my house, but I kind of liked to stay in the background. I didn't like to be in the front. But every once in a while, I'd have to let the safety valve go. And I wouldn't do anything outrageous, but I would do something very atypical. The whole neighborhood was all military families, right? I invited these three kids over. My two brothers were outside playing ball. My parents were at work. And my two sisters, they were at little kids' school. I invited them over. We're down in the den. And I just said, I bet I can drink a glass of everything in this bar. And they looked at me, no, you can't do that. And I just said, watch me. So I got this big glass out, and I put something of everything, every bottle, in that glass. Whether it was brown, clear, green, blue, red, whatever color it was in my glass. And I topped it off with a hefty dose of cream de menthe. My mom liked it. To this day, I hate Girl Scout Thin Mint cookies. I mixed it all up, and I didn't have any idea what was going to happen. I was determined to drink the whole thing down in one fell swoop. It was a pretty tall glass. It tasted awful, and it burned, so I could only do half of it at one time. But when that first half of glass hit me, there was that warmth, that calm, that peace. I remember I even laughed because this happiness came over me, and I laughed. But I had double-dared myself to drink the whole thing. So I drank the rest of it down, glug, glug, glug. Well, all of a sudden, I'm just like floating, just floating like this. And next thing I knew, somebody was throwing me in the cold shower with all my clothes on saying, don't tell your mother. That was the last time I drank until I was 21. But thereafter, when I drank, that was my purpose, was to get to that point. So, this next thing, I'm only going to touch on it because it was the incident that set me out on full control of my life. I was never going to be vulnerable again, and nobody was ever going to be telling me what to do. So as I said before, my dad was kind of erratic. He drank a lot, and he was what you call a mean drunk. And so this one night, it's about 2 weeks before my 18th birthday, he comes home and he's especially drunk and especially mean. And his focus was on me that particular night. Well, push comes to shove, and he's after me with a hatchet. So I run into the bathroom. I got the door locked, and he's at the door chopping away. And I can't get out the window because there's iron bars attached permanently to the outside of the building. So I'm kind of backed up to the opposite wall of the door, and I'm watching this very much in the moment, very much waiting to see what's going to be revealed. And he gets through the door. You know, he has access to reach in and unlock the door. And, well, you know how, tears are going to come, sorry. You know how we hear people say and we talk about how God protects us, even when he's not a thought in our mind. So he gets through the door. He flings it open. He was only 40, 41 years old. He still had the hatchet in his hand, but he was in such pain, and he couldn't breathe. And he bent over. He was bent over. He couldn't stand up. And so I left the room. And 3 days after my 18th birthday, I left home. And I had this, it wasn't like a conscious thing, but I made up my mind that I would never be that vulnerable again. And the thing is I wasn't, but even, I've been married 3 times. My first 2 husbands were when I was drinking. But even in those intimate relationships, the only exception was my daughter. I just was always that close from actually having a true intimate relationship with those people. Just couldn't quite get to know me, and I didn't quite want to get to know you. And so I kind of went through life like that until I got sober. I ended up marrying a guy who was on his way to flight school. He was in the Army, and then Vietnam was coming at the end of the year once he got through that. So that happened, and we had a baby daughter. He comes back from Vietnam. We're transferred down to Fort Knox, Kentucky for 2 years, then up to Fort Devens outside of Boston, and then down to Hunter Stewart for a different kind of flight school. And then we went out to Fort Huachuca in Arizona. And Fort Huachuca sits like halfway between Tucson and Nogales on the border. By that time, it was time for me to have our second child. We had been expecting a second child, and he was due. He was full term, but 3 days before he's born, we find out that he's not going to survive past the second day. And that's what happened. And he's buried out there on Fort Huachuca. It's a beautiful cemetery. It's like a small Arlington. It's just gorgeous, set in the desert. The way the funeral went, I never got to see his headstone. I never got to see his actual grave. And for all these years, I never went back to see his grave. Well, last year, being sober and confident, and I had the resources, last August, at the end of August, I had the opportunity to go back, see his headstone for the very first time. It was very cathartic, and it was just a beautiful closure on that chapter of my life for me. So anyway, that was 1972. We're still at Fort Huachuca. Got to back up a little bit. And Vietnam was winding down. Well, all these guys had come on voluntary and definite. So now they had to make up their minds. You're going to be regular Army, or we'll give you $10,000, and you can get out. Well, at that time in 1972, $10,000 was a lot of money, and it would give a young family a really good start on a new life. And so we took the cash, and we moved to Daytona Beach. Well, all this time in the Army and traveling around, we partied like the Army people do. But we had to kind of do it within these parameters because there's the MPs and the local authorities, right? So we had to kind of modify it. But we all were drinking to get drunk. Our motivations may have all been different at that time, but that was our purpose. So in Daytona Beach, we just took advantage of that full party scene, right? On the front, our life was very kind of traditional. He taught at the community college. I worked as a teller in a bank. My daughter went to the Catholic school. We had this nice little house in South Daytona. But behind all that was a lot of volatility. Our drinking was exponentially increasing, and we partied everywhere and anywhere at any time. And there was no physical abuse, but there was a lot of violent language and hateful. It was just a hateful, unhappy atmosphere. And, well, I was just looking for an excuse, and after 12 years of marriage, I learned that my husband is having an affair with my neighbor, and that was my excuse. So I filed for divorce, and 2 years later, my daughter and I moved out to San Diego. I always considered San Diego my hometown because my dad was always returned there from time to time. I got a job by the end of the week. I always had an easy time finding a job back then, and I took classes to get better jobs as I went along. I also found this place called the Flint Springs Inn. So in Daytona Beach, it's drinking and disco. I love to dance. In San Diego, out in East County, it was down the street from the rodeo, was drinking and line dancing. So in the beginning, I was there every Friday and Saturday night. I'd get there when the band started. I was one of the last people to walk out. My daughter was in high school by then. She had her own social life. Because I was so restricted, in my life, I wanted my daughter to have all the freedom that I didn't have. And so she had a lot of latitude. There was underlying structure, you know, like you had a kind of a curfew, and you had to go to school, those kinds of things. But outside of that, she could pretty much do whatever she wanted. I think what happened was is she had a little bit more freedom than her maturity, than she could handle, and she went on to have her own issues with drugs and alcohol as her life progressed. I never socialized with people at work. It wasn't that I was ashamed of my drinking. To me, drinking was just part of living. It's just what you did. You got drunk on your off hours. At work, I had to be professional and responsible looking, and I knew that if I partied with the people that I worked with, they would no longer consider me to be responsible and professional. I hung out with people that drank just the way I did. That's what I did outside of work. And my job was like who I was, kind of a thing. So my daughter gets through high school. She decides she wants to go back to Daytona Beach to live. And I add a couple more nights at the Flint Springs Inn. And then at 42, I learn that my father has died. I always had this fear that he was going to come back and find me and just explode my life. So now I find out he's dead. And I'm going, I am now 100% free. I double down on my drinking. I'm now out at Flint Springs Inn. They're open 6 nights a week. I'm out there probably close to 5 nights a week, sometimes 6. Always getting there when the band starts, being one of the last people to leave. I was everybody's friend. They were my friend. And hey, if you needed a ride home, I don't care if you had on a trench coat and wore a patch on your eye. If you needed a ride home, I was your girl. I had no fear. I never thought that anybody would ever hurt me, and they never did. I don't know if I had this aura around me or whatever it was, but there was, I never thought of it, and it never happened. So this one night, I really kind of overdid it, more than normal. I was just really almost, I'm going to say unconscious. I wasn't quite that far gone, but anyway, I get in my car, and it just kind of like this. All I could see was my steering wheel. And I knew where I was, but I couldn't remember how to get home. And so I'm just going, focus, focus, focus. And then I remembered I had to go west to get home. No cell phones back then, and everybody else is gone. So I get out on the dirt road. I see the sign that says 8 West, and I get on 8 West, and I start going. I feel like I'm going 5 miles an hour. But, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, Kmart's had that blue light special thing on the little basket. Well, the store that I liked to shop at had a big blue light on top of the building, and it ran 24/7. So I'm going along like this, and I look up, and I see the blue light, and I kind of know where I am, and I tell myself, go towards the light. And so I did. I remember crawling a little bit of the way to the phone booth. I called a friend. They came and picked me up. And thereafter, for a short period of time, if I felt I was not going to be able to get home, I would call them and they would come and pick me up. Well, that was very short-lived. They got tired of doing that. So I just said, well, I'll just drink at home, because by that time, the dancing and the socializing was secondary. So I started drinking at home, and I started drinking only wine because it was cheap and I could get a lot of it. I had gotten in the habit of setting my alarm when I came home from work, when I was going out or if I was drinking or whatever. That way I knew that I would always get up and get to work the next day. There was a 7-Eleven around the corner that I would get my wine from. And on Fridays, so that I wouldn't have to leave the house all weekend, I would buy 2 4-liter bottles of wine. And I was good for the weekend. I was kind of getting tired, I guess, tired of a lot of stuff. And this one night, I'm on my way to 7-Eleven, and I think to myself, you know, I'm exhausted. I just want to go to sleep and never wake up again. So I got my wine. I went home. I started drinking. I didn't write out a suicide note. What I wrote was a list of things for people to do at work on Monday, because I wasn't going to be there to tell them what needed to be done. And even though I wasn't there, I'd still be doing my 150%, right? Information for my daughter, and I asked my neighbor if she would take my cat. So, but come Sunday, that was my designated day after I was able to get the pills. I just kept putting off the pill. I started drinking first thing in the morning, which was not my normal thing. I just kept putting off the pills, and the reason that I didn't want to take the pills right away was because I wanted to make sure that I would not fall asleep before I took them all. Well, guess what happens when you drink wine all day from first thing in the morning? You fall asleep eventually or pass out or whatever. That's what happens. I wake up, it's Monday. I call my boss. I say, you know, I'm not feeling so great today. I don't think I should come in. And because of my work record, he bought it. He said, okay, we'll see you tomorrow. I hang up the phone. Again, no cell phone, there's a landline. Hang up the phone. I turn around. I see my unopened pills, my drunken scrawls on my yellow tablet. And you know how sometimes you have a thought where it's like 10 thoughts and they all come together at one time and it's like one thing. So I had this, I immediately understood, wow, look where my drinking has got me to. I immediately understand. If I don't do something, if I don't get some help, those pills are still going to be there next weekend. And I'll do something different next weekend to make sure there's no mistakes, right? And I immediately understand that I needed something stronger than my self-will. I don't know why that thought came to me. I definitely wasn't thinking about God, but I knew that I needed something strong, stronger than me. And whatever they were, whoever they were, I was going to do whatever they said. I was going to therapy at the time. I called my therapist. She fit me in, and I took up her whole two-hour lunch. She took my pills and my notes, but she exchanged them for the AA San Diego County meeting schedule. And she said, pick one, come back on Wednesday and we'll talk about it. So I did that. Your sign out front says, welcome home. I never noticed that before. Well, this place that I went to was called the Boiled Owl, you know, just like in that story where the guy's boiled as an owl. Halfway house. There was a liquor store underneath it and a bunch of little stores, and people lived above the stores, and it was an older part of town. I go up the stairs, and the first thing I see is this sign at the top of the stairs that says, welcome home, Billy Graham. And I go into the first meeting room. It's a small one. It's about 6 feet wide, and there's chairs like this, and there's a window at the end. And I sit down. And across from me are these three other little signs, and they say, nobody act big, nobody act small, everybody act medium. I knew right then I was in the right place. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't have to have any answers for any questions. I can just sit here and I can just be. So the meeting starts, and you know, just like God was just a word on a page, the word alcoholic was only a word on a page. I never connected the dots with anything as far as the word alcoholic was. Came my turn to introduce myself, and involuntarily, as a matter of course, just like I was just introducing myself, I said, my name is Patricia and I'm an alcoholic. I felt no shame, I felt no regret. It was just like, well, now I know who I am. And everything that everybody said in that meeting, I understood, I identified with. I met my first sponsor there. I knew I was coming back. When I walked out of the meeting, I knew I was coming back. She told me that she was going to be my sponsor. And I go, oh boy, I don't have to do anything. My sponsor just fell in my lap. Well, she's what you call a Nazi sponsor. But I liked that. I liked her direct way of talking to me. She said what she thought and what she felt, and I liked that. I could understand it and I could grasp it. So she started me on the steps right away. She didn't shove me through them, but as soon as it was evident that I understood the principle underlying that step that I just talked about earlier, and that I could make it a stab at using that principle in my life going forward, we went on to the next step. That went on for, it was close to a year, and I met the man that would be my third husband. His name was Richard. He had 6 years more sobriety in AA than I did. He was heavily involved in service, and that's how I met him. He had a very strong spirituality about him, and AA was the center of his life. We were definitely not joined at the hip because we were definitely not a match made in heaven, but we were committed to each other. We were committed to our marriage. We were committed to our sobriety, and we were committed to our common spirituality. We did conventions and we helped with the newsletter, we did phones together, we went to visit people in their homes together. We did all those kinds of we did AA together. And we were married for 27 and a half years. And at the end of 2019, he started chemotherapy. And, well, they told us that probably he had a year and a half. He could, if everything went perfect, the chances are it would be a year and a half. Well, talk about constancy. It's always been an important thing for me. The only humans that were constant in my life were my daughter and this man, Richard. And he was leaving. My self-will just, the revolving door was going around, and I just pushed God out, and my self-will came in. I decided I was going to always be there for him, do everything I could for him. Well, then COVID hit. That was a further complication, and I felt like I was always battling the medical community so he could get the care that I thought he should have. And so a lot of self-will there. So anyway, he died that first week of January in 2021. I'm still stuck in really hardcore self-will. When I'm that way, if I have set my mind to do something, I make a plan, I write out a list, and I do it, and I get it done real quickly. So my daughter lives here in Noonan. So by May 5th of 2021, and my mom died in April of 21, shortly after he did. By May of 2021, I'm driving into Noonan with my daughter. She met me halfway in Amarillo, and we drove the rest of the way together. I already had a place, and everything by the time I got here. My stuff was in a U-Haul iPod, multiple U-Haul iPods, and it was all on its way. And I got all set up, and for the next year, I just hid out. But on May 28th of 2022 would have been my husband's 36th birthday, AA birthday. And so I had ordered him a medallion. It came, I put it in front of his picture, stuck a candle and a brownie, said the Serenity Prayer, and had this imaginary meeting with him. The span of time from when he started chemo and when this meeting happened was 3 years. I had not gone to a meeting in 3 years. I didn't drink. I didn't have a desire to drink. No meetings, no phone calls, no God. And I knew I had to get back to AA. My birthday was on a Saturday, and there was a meeting that night, so I went to that meeting. I took a blue chip. I met the woman that would be my first sponsor here in Noonan. I said, you know, I need to start the steps all over again. I need to start reading the big book and from the Roman numeral pages going forward. You know, can I call you from time to time? Of course. So step one and two, okay. Step three, it's like a mine with that imaginary wall, right? I just couldn't do it. I could not talk to God. I could hardly even think about him. And so I talked to my sponsor about it, and she kept saying, it's fear. And I was highly insulted because I'm little, but I can be tough. And so it's just how I am. My daughter always thought I was mean. So anyway, so I was insulted by that. And she kept sending me texts about fear. Read this about fear. Write this about fear. And she talked to me, fear, 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 fear. Well, she was bugging the crap out of me, but you know what? I knew from AA about willingness and following suggestions, and so I did everything that she asked me to do. One morning, I'm sitting there, and you know how when someone close to you passes, and you're still talking to them, right? You know, having these little conversations. You're not crazy. It's just you're just talking to this person, and that's what I would do. Well, I realized I was afraid. I was afraid that if I went to God first, that I would be disconnected from the spirit of my husband. I would not be able to talk to him. And so, reluctantly, I did what she asked me to do, and I started talking to God on purpose. I made myself do it. It felt like homework, and I have always hated school. But I did it. You know, it would be morning God, you know, that kind of a thing. Then pretty soon, it was like, okay, it's time to talk to God. It was like a habit kind of a thing. And then after a while, it's, oh, wow, I get to talk to God this morning. And then after a while, a few weeks after that, it was like, it's 2 o'clock. I talked to God this morning, but I think I'll talk to him again. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, it was like, I talked to God this morning. I talked to him at 2 o'clock. I'm getting ready to go to bed. hi, God, good night, God, and by the way, thank you, God. And so my life started to roll, and then later on that year, with the help of my sponsor, it was still 22, I was able to forgive my parents in that way that we talked about when we were doing step 7, which is real forgiveness is when you just forget it about what happened. Whatever happened is forgotten. It's not there anymore. My life began to flow just a little bit more. And then in February of 23, I won't go into the details because it would take too long to tell you the story. I had my only burning bush experience that I've ever had in sobriety. And I was just sitting there one night, and I just started getting this intuition. God was that telling me, do this, 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 and this. Get up and do it right now. Do this, 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 and this. And I did it. And by the end of the event, what had happened was God had opened the door and let me walk out of grief. Starting the very next day, every day was like, God, what do you got for me? What more will be revealed? Just put it in my path, whatever you got. I'm your girl. I'll do it. Life was, it was joyful. It was not quite a pink cloud, but it was joyful. And I looked forward to every day and what God wanted me to do, what he wanted me to see. I saw God's will in everything, except this one time, it was a miss. It was a speed bump. The thing was not God's will. But the lesson that I learned from the thing was God's will. So the exuberance kind of, but I'm on the other side of that thing right now. I go to like 5 meetings a week, and I plan my life around those 5 meetings. I start my day with talking to God and the entities or people or whatever you want to say that I greet include my mother and my father. I try to meet once a week with a couple of women that I sponsor. It doesn't always work out that way, but we make adjustments. And I have, you know, there's different little small acts of service that I do at the meetings and things like that. Some days I don't get what I call the perfection connection, but I'm still connected. My self-will is in the revolving door, and God's always beside me. I never push God into the revolving door anymore. Sometimes I feel sorry for my self-will, and I say, okay, you can come out, but God never leaves my side. What I've learned mostly, most recently, is how much I have yet to learn, how much I don't know. That makes my life feel like a mini adventure, and I love adventure. I want to thank all these women here because they have all been silently supporting me when I've been vigorously resisting their support and their help. I don't like to ask for help. I can do it myself, right? So anyway, I just want to say, and if I don't express that love, respect openly, I do feel it. If you don't see it, I feel it for sure. So I just want to read one thing. I came to believe it is an AA-approved literature. It's just not a text. And then I'll be done. For those of you who don't know, Came to Believe is a book that is a compilation of little stories by people about how they came to believe in their higher power. This one's very, very short. It's called Total Surrender. What has always impressed me most about the program and myself is the constant, continuing challenge to try recapturing some of the true and honest rapture I felt upon total surrender when I first came into AA. For me, that special peace of mind has never been duplicated. Now, after all the accumulated 24-hour periods, I realize that it probably never will be. I have come close to it a few times, but it's never the same. I think there is a relationship between that feeling and our need at the time we were introduced to the program. Our motivation, I believe, is a combination of enough hurt and the grace of God. Surely a strange combination. I would not know how to express it to anyone outside it. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Trish.
Patricia, thank you so much. That was awesome.